now.
11 hour and I. Now the lights dim low. Soon we'll start the show. Here comes Al Penwood.
All your bitterness and lies sting like tears in my eyes. And a thousand lovesick tunes won't wash away the wounds from my mind. You've been sitting around, you're a new sensation. You got a better deal and you took his invitation. You've been sitting on his lap and taking his dictation. What but mercy? We used to love all day and dry all night. Jealousy used to whet your appetite. Mercy. We were low as dogs and high as kites. Why must I plead with you, darling? Why must I plead with you, darling? Why must I plead with you, darling? What's already mine? Well, my friends are indiscreet, and I sing myself to sleep. I don't mind the red wine or the pickup line, as long as it's cheap. Oh, I ask you what's what, and you say I'm all yours. I ask who your friend is, and you say it's Santa Claus. I ask you to come home, you say you're tired of being indoors. Oh, but mercy. You know you signed on that dotted line. Oh, mercy. Well, you sign yours, I sign mine. Oh, mercy. You said for a turn in the time. Oh, why must I plead with you, darling? Why must I plead with you, darling? Why must I plead with you, darling? Oh, it's already mine. I said, why must I plead? Darling, what's already
Richard Thompson on the Midwood Files. Hello, my name's L.F. Midwood, or still L.F. Midwood. we have the death of the president occurring, I think yesterday. It started to break, I don't know, I guess it was like 10 or 11 o'clock at night. I'm gonna give the devil his due on this one. I wasn't really a GH fan, I guess with GHW, George Herbert Walker, or George Bush Sr. Was not a big fan. I actually voted for, that was the first election I could vote in. I remember being somewhat psyched about that. First election I voted in, I believe. I had to think about it. There's math involved, so I'm never really good at that. Not a big fan of either of the Bushes, quite frankly, but I think, you know, it's funny, as much as the media made a big deal, and that would be the liberal media, made a big deal, and I was a liberal at the time, so just to set the stage properly. Liberal media set the stage for Bush Sr. being a mean, evil guy, the dude had a serious, serious resume. I mean, if you stop and think about it, as far as presidents go, I think he certainly outshined Kennedy in regards to his level of service to the country prior to running for president. I mean, seriously, I just want to grab out of Wikipedia because it's the quickest thing to do. Born June 12th, 1924, died November 30th, 2018. Was an American politician who served as the 44th president of the United States from 1989 to 1993. Prior to assuming the presidency, Bush served as the 43rd Vice President of the United States from 1981 to 1989 as a member of the Republican Party. He had previously been and this is where the resume starts. He had previously been a U.S. Representative, Ambassador, and Director of the Central Intelligence Agency. During his career in public service, he was simply known as George Bush. From 2001 until his death, he was often referred to as George H.W. Bush or Bush 41 or George Bush Sr. I'll use George Bush Sr. for the for convenience for myself and for you. To distinguish him from his eldest son, George W. Bush, the 43rd President of the United States. As a scion of the Bush family, he was born in Milton, Massachusetts to Preston Bush and Dorothy Walker Bush. Following the attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, Bush postponed his university studies, enlisted in the United States Navy on his 18th birthday, and became the youngest aviator in the U.S. Navy at the time. He served until September 1945, the last president to have participated in a war. Interesting. And then attended Yale University, graduating in 1948. He moved his family to West Texas, where he entered the oil business and became a millionaire by the age of 40. In 1964, soon after founding his own oil company, Bush became involved in politics. He was defeated in his first election for the U.S. Senate in 1964, but won the election to the House of Representatives from Texas's 7th District in 1966. He was reelected in 68, but was defeated for election to the Senate again in 1970. In 1971, President Richard Nixon appointed Bush as ambassador to the United Nations. I did not know that. And in 1973, Bush became chairman of the Republican National Committee. That I did know. The following year, President Gerald Ford appointed Bush as the chief liaison officer in China and later reassigned Bush to the position of director of the Central Intelligence Agency. That I did know. Bush ran for president in 1980, but was defeated in the Republican primary by Ronald Reagan. Reagan chose Bush as his running mate, and Bush became vice president after the Reagan-Bush ticket won in the 1980 election. Whew. During his 8-year tenure as vice president, Bush headed the administration task forces on deregulation and prosecuting the war on drugs. In 1988, Bush ran a second successful campaign to succeed Ronald Reagan as president, defeating Democratic opponent Michael Dukakis, becoming the first incumbent vice president in 152 years to be elected president. Foreign policy drove the Bush presidency. Military operations were conducted in Panama and the Persian Gulf. The Berlin Wall fell in 1989, and the Soviet Union dissolved 2 years later. Although the agreement was not ratified until after he left office, Bush was also signed NAFTA, right, which created a trade bloc consisting of the United States, Canada, and Mexico, much to the United States' detriment, I believe. Domestically, Bush reneged in a 1988 campaign promise after, after a struggle with Congress, signed an increases in taxes, no new taxes, if you recall, that Congress had passed in the wake of a weak recovery from an economic recession, along with continuing budget deficits and diminutive of foreign politics as a major issue in the post Cold War climate. He lost the 1992 election to Democrat Bill Clinton, who I voted for at the time. Anyway, Bush left office in 1993. His presidential library was dedicated in 97. As he was active along with Bill Clinton in humanitarian activities, while George W. Bush's victory in the 2000 presidential election, Bush and his son had become the second father-son pair to serve in the presidency, along with John Adams and John Quincy Adams. Bush's second son, Jeb Bush, served as the 43rd governor of Florida and sought the Republican nomination in 2006. Bush died November 30th, 2018, at the age of 171 days. At the time of his death, he was the longest-lived president in American history. I'm not going to go any farther than that. But when you actually look at that, you know, as far as the military record and actually participating in a war, which is more than we could say for his son, I suppose, and you look at that he'd actually served several other public offices, primarily out of Texas. He's revered in Texas. He always was. There's a highway named after him. And actually, I think there's a highway named after him, and I think there's a highway named after Johnson in near Dallas. I think it's referred to as Daddy Bush Freeway, actually, if I recall correctly. So He's just one of those interesting guys that, like, his presidency kind of fell between two eras, and he just kind of didn't make it that second term. And it's really odd for a president not to make a second term. I mean, it doesn't happen that often. I think also one of the records that he set was, I believe, he and his marriage to his wife, which was, I think, 53 or 54 years at the time he had left office. And ultimately, I think, went to 74 years, was the longest marriage of a president and a first lady in U.S. history as well, too. In recent years, and it's really been kind of interesting because, again, with the Humanitarian Acts, in recent years, he's teamed up with Bill Clinton on a lot of issues. Haiti, I believe, is one of them. And I believe there's the tsunami that hit in Indonesia going back quite some time ago. I think my impression of him when I was younger, and you gotta remember, I was like, when did I vote? I was like 20. First time I voted, I was 20. I'm trying to recall if that was actually the first. I have to do this mathematically. I couldn't vote in 84, but I could vote in 88. So I think I voted in 88. Yeah, I think I voted for whoever Reagan wound up defeating in 88. And that might have been, I don't know if that was Dukakis, if Dukakis made two runs or not. You know what? It's such a long time ago. It was many, many doobies ago, as they say. So I have no friggin' idea. But I definitely voted in that election, too. And it's really interesting. The Clinton years really represented a fair amount of prosperity for a lot of people, including myself. And then quickly ended when he left office, which is really kind of interesting if I think about it. I don't know. I'm trying to think about, like, what personal feelings I have about the guy. And I think I never really kind of got over that whole spook imagery in regards to being head of the CIA for as long as he was. I don't know. I just always had negative issue, negative imagery of our foreign policy. And I still have it to some degree, but not as severe as I used to. I've reached the conclusion that the vast majority of the world is going to hate us no matter what we do. So we might as well just act in our own interest and get it over with. Let's see. I know the National Day of Mourning is set to be on the 5th of December, I think I read. And it's interesting because the last time a president died, or no, that wouldn't be the last time, it would be the time before that. When Nixon died, I was working for the post office and I got a day off because there was no mail delivery on that National Day of Mourning. I know when Reagan died, there had to be a National Day of Mourning, but I don't think I was in any sort of any sort of framework to actually appreciate it, you know, not for nothing, you know, living in pajamas since that should be the thing under my thing. I'm going to put that maybe under my podcast, you know, living in pajamas since like 04. I think that'll work because it's actually kind of true. You know, it's I think a lot of people also look at the first Gulf War and look at that rather negative. But to me, I don't, you know, even at the time, I mean, you know, no blood for oil. Okay. But Saddam was obviously like out of control. I mean, I don't think that there's like any way of denying that, to the point where he obviously invaded Kuwait, which technically, if we go back into history, into the not that far turn of the century history, the English had carved out of a section of Iraq. They just kind of took like one of the more oil rich pieces and just turned it into a whole other country. This was like around the same time as it was about right the same time they left, coincidentally, or at least stopped policing as emphatically as they had been. So yeah, you know, the first Gulf War I think might have been justified, quite frankly, and I think that that's somewhat proven by the fact that he was able to put that coalition together of Arab countries. I guess they were concerned that they were going to be next. I believe he was also able to keep Israel on its chain. I think that was done by was it Patriot missiles, that some Patriot missile batteries that had been installed over in Israel to protect them to some degree from the Scud missiles. I think the Soviet built, I believe those were Soviet built Scud missiles, could be wrong about that, that Saddam had been chucking at Israel. So yeah, you gotta give him some credit for holding all that together. You know, it's, I think, not for nothing, I think if anything, his son, who obviously wound up becoming president after him, winds up being a lot more justifiably maligned, I think maybe the term would be. I think the old man gets a little bit, you know, a little bit too much negativity, you know, a little bit too much, not for nothing. It's interesting when a president dies. I mean, we become somewhat reflective to the point of, you know, if we were alive and we voted for him. Now, again, I voted against him. But still, I specifically remember voting, because, you know, voting, I don't know how it works in the rest of the country, and I guess it works like this in major cities, or most major cities, is voting booths are generally in public schools. So public schools will close early or maybe not even open on election day. And that'll give people, they roll out, and this used to, in the old days, it was the old lever vote, you know, nyeh, nyeh, you know, ch-ch-ch, and then nyeh, master. Yeah, I remember. And like I said, I'm still trying to... I couldn't, you know what, I'm pretty sure that was the first election I had actually voted in, if I think about it, if I actually, like, stop and think about it for a moment, because it would have made sense, because it would have been, he served from 89 to 92, let me make sure I got that right. So you don't want to get into math, I always have, like, problems, I just don't do good with math, it's never been one of my things. Let me see. Do, 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 do. Let's see. 81 is member of Republican Party. 89. Where is it? Where is he? Yeah, okay. 89 to 93. So, yeah, it had to be. It had to be, because I was just too young to... Reagan was elected in 80. And then he won in 84, and that would have taken us to right around 89. You know, the elections were in 88. That's probably what I'm thinking of. And in 89, he was sworn in. So, yeah. Yeah, so that's it. It was right after... I'm going to close this because I don't think I need it. And I don't know how much my lighting is going to change, because the screen is actually a bit brighter when I pop open articles. I do have some articles. I want to, in the bottom part of the hour... I want to talk a little bit more about Assange, because things got like really flipping weird with that this week. Whoa. So we'll save that another 10 minutes or so. We've been to the bottom of the hour. I think going forward, what I'm probably going to do is I'm going to cut the show into two pieces. I'll talk about one thing, probably a little bit about whatever's going on with me, and then whatever, if there's a major or bigger news story that I want to lead with. And then the last half hour will be either something new or the follow-up on something I was talking about next week, so that it stays kind of, you know, compartmentalized. I hope sometime into the new year, not too long into the new year, to get the show back up to 90 or even 2 minutes or even 2 hours possibly. I think I'm going to be playing music, but I think I'm going to be playing less music. I haven't exactly decided how I want to implement that, but I think it's important that the show get back up, especially if I'm capable of handling it. And it doesn't look like I really have too much of a choice, and I can't stay at an hour for long. I really feel that I'm not, you know, my audience is exceedingly disappointed that I only do 60 minutes, and then I wind up playing music to boot, or at least I will tonight. I'm trying to put myself, you know, back to where I was in those days, and you know, I was such a liberal. I mean, it's like radicalized. You know, that was like a lot of time with Randy up at Randy's place. I remember doing a story on the Gulf War and how the Gulf War was basically pretty much, if not a setup, it was at least to the circumstance of, you know, this goes back to the story with April Glaspie, who I believe was ambassador to Iraq at that point in time, where the message or signals that we sent to Iraqi government, and specifically Saddam Hussein, is that if that whatever they did, we would stay out of their way. We would not get involved. And as it turns out, we did. So it's a question of whether he was led to believe one thing just so that we can find ourselves and, you know, get ourselves into a war, you know, in Panama as well. And not for nothing, there was a little bit of shooting over there. I mean, we forget about Panama with Noriega. But that was, you know, those two things are so, quote unquote, conspiracy related. And, you know, and it's an interesting thing because there's a, you know, and I didn't pull anything on it tonight. I suppose I could have if I wanted to, but I was too busy looking at other stuff and working on other things and trying to think about what I want to do tonight. But there are a lot of conspiracy theories, stories that kind of linger around the old man. You know, the primary one would be that he was directly involved with the assassination of JFK. There's a supposedly film. I say video because I'm so used to saying video, but back then it would have been film. Of him in Dealey Plaza on the, you know, like when the assassination took place. But he says he was somewhere halfway across the country at that point in time, and it was never really, I don't believe it was ever pursued to any degree within the Warren Commission. But yeah, there's stories of him being there. There's, you know, there's some evidence of him being there. There's some, and at least there's, let's put it this way. There's evidence of him being there. That's all there is. There is nothing else. So, you know, before we start, you know, running off, running to the races, I believe he's also implicated in 9/11 to one degree or another, or at least assets of his supposedly tied up in 9/11. So, I mean, this is one thing I've found, you know, not all conspiracies, theories are untrue, but every major event that kind of happens, and sometimes even not a major event that occurs, there generally tends to be, within hours, if not days, there tends to be some sort of conspiracy attached to it. You know, follow the money. And, you know, I think I'm going to start watching The X-Files again. I think I want to watch The X-Files one more time, all the way through. I know they got all wacky towards the end and really stupid liberal, and, you know, it's always whatever. But that show, like, helped shape the mind of a generation, which is actually quite scary if you think about it. But I think I might, zip through those again because I'm certainly not reading. I had planned on reading. That was maybe my New Year's resolution for this year will be to be a nicer person, which I don't think is going to. See, that's why you should always have like a plan B. So I think maybe to be a nice person, to lose like 30 pounds, and to read more. So I think out of like three of those, I think I could probably maybe get that last one in there if I try hard enough, you know. I'm going to be going back into the kitchen, and I'll be doing the vast majority of the cooking in the house in a couple of few weeks, which is, I'm kind of like ambivalent about it, you know. It was such a long time since I've done it on a daily basis, you know. So getting in there and, you know, chopping the onions and, you know, and dicing the carrots and all that stuff. I mean, just the real grunt work is going, you know. It's the hardest part of it is getting the mise en place ready. But once you've done that, you know, cooking is cooking. Once you get the physics of it, you know, it's kind of like a bicycle, I suppose, or possibly other things, where supposedly you don't forget. So I'm kind of hoping it winds up being muscle memory. And I can get back into it without any hassles. And I'm actually looking forward to it because I'm a pretty good cook. Not for gun, I'm the best cook in the house. So, I mean, the upgrade is that everything will taste better. You know, the food will all taste better. The downside is I got to cut put a couple of few hours a day into it. But mostly it's prep. If I can get up earlier, that's maybe another resolution I should look into. I got how much is left in the year? November, there's a little bit of 5 weeks or something like that. Something like that, 6 weeks. So maybe I should look into having more normal sleep patterns, you know. It would also make it easier for my friends to find me. I got people who they message me and, you know, they'll friggin' text me on my phone to try to make an appointment to talk to me because I'm just not awake when they're awake. I'm like really, really sleeping way too much, not sleeping well, and then when I finally do get to sleep, I'm sleeping 12 hours, and then I'll wake up at 5 or 6 o'clock, and I'll get I'll see this message from somebody, and I'll return it. But there'll be weeks where I won't be doing that, where I'll just I'll be getting up a little bit earlier because I have an appointment. So I'm a believe it or not, for a guy who really doesn't go anywhere too much, I'm a hard guy to pin down. So yes, if you wish to be speaking to the Midwood, you must be making appointments. It comes down to that. But it's worth it. It's usually worth it because I give you now a lollipop at the end, and then, I'll pat you on the head, and I'll say, man. So that being said, I just kind of want to close out this segment of the show, the opening segment of the show. In memoriam to President Bush, Godspeed there, sir. I can't imagine it's easy to be president of the United States, left, right, whatever your politics are. I mean, if you look at these guys, right, you see how they go in, right? And even 4 years later, let alone 8 years later, you see how they come out. I mean, they're all gray hair. Imagine that kind of stress. I'd be I would blow up. I would explode. It would be the end of me. It would be the end of me. And I don't think those guys are allowed to be on, drugs, you know what I mean? So, I kind of feel bad for them, having to deal with all that stress without drugs. Imagine that. Oh, my God. Oh, my God, I don't think I would fare very well. But by the same token, I don't think I'll be running for office anytime soon. I can. Interestingly enough, this is really kind of funny. In the state of Rhode Island, I can run for public office because they changed the laws here that you can be a felon and still run for public office because of Buddy Cianci. I gotta finish reading that book on Buddy Cianci, and then I'll do a show on Buddy Cianci because Buddy Cianci is an interesting character. Not just here, but he's been on. They had him on Fox. He was on Fox more than a few times in the latter years of his life, and he hosted a radio show here. And it's just an interesting story if you don't know it. And he's not exactly what I would call a national figure, but he's obviously on the East Coast. He's got a little bit more renowned. But he's a fascinating guy, and I think he's worthy of doing the show. So I might put that on the menu for some time before the year's over. Like I said, with that being said, I want to hit a music break, and then I'm going to come back, and I want to talk about Julian Assange and what's been going on with that. So I need to do that, and let me see. That's already up, so I could do this, I could do that, I could go like that, and I think I could hit this.
Radio New York. International RNI. I couldn't read your mind, line after line. Line after line, it was written in your eyes. I guess it's no surprise, time after time. Line after line, you brought
This is 11LRNI, and you're listening to the LF Midwood Experience.
My mic working, there it is. Whoa. You know, 9 times out of 10, I just mute it out. Like, watch, I'll just hit a button, and it comes back up. See? It's right on top of the channel. That time, I actually... button back on, so you couldn't hear what I said. When I lowered it and hit the mute button. So when I turned the mute button back on, when I unmuted it, it was still at zero gain. So actually, it was negative zero, which meant that you couldn't hear me. So anyway, welcome to the other side. Maybe I'll just start calling this the other side, because at least for a little bit going forward to the end of the new year, I think I want to hit 3 tunes. I think I want an open song. I think I want a middle kind of bridge song. And then I think, of course, the song to close it out. The Ring It On Home, as they say. So that was Ozzy Osbourne, Time After Time, in case anybody was wondering. All right, so let's talk a little bit more about Julian Assange. I know last week I had, just because I kind of felt like it and things were getting kind of hairy there again with the releasing of the information that it looked like that he was being, charges were being brought against him by the U.S. government. I'm going to move this all the way over to the side because I need to get to my mouse. Okay, so I'm going to pop up, what am I going to do? I'm going to pop up, there's a couple of articles. I picked one strictly because this would be, which one do I want? Not that one, and it's not that one either. I got the wrong article. All right, well, anyway, I'll read, and this is dated, from 3 days ago, I believe, and this is Vox, VLX. It's been a whirlwind 24 hours of news and about special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. First on Monday night, Mueller's team said that former campaign chair Paul Manafort, who had agreed to cooperate with their investigation, had breached his agreement by repeatedly lying to them. The special counsel has not yet offered specifics on what Manafort allegedly lied about, and the ultimate implications of the news for the probe aren't clear. Okay, so we don't know what that means. They're saying he's lying, and they're not saying what he's lying about, and we don't know how that affects the rest of it, obviously. But some curiosities around the disclosure's timing suggest that Mueller may have wanted to wait until President Donald Trump submitted his answers to some of investigators' questions last week before revealing the news. Yeah. Okay. Second, on Tuesday, The Guardian, The Guardian published a stunning report alleging that Manafort had secretly met with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange during the 2016 campaign. But the story has been vigorously disputed by WikiLeaks and Manafort, and has not yet been confirmed by any other news outlet. It is best to treat it with caution for now. Okay, now this was a few days ago. Let me move this and see if I can make this easier for myself. Yes, I can. Okay. Finally, in the midst of all this, conservative commentator Jerome Corsi, who has been under Mueller's scrutiny for months, keeps coming forward with eyebrow-raising new claims about his involvement in the investigation. Corsi has already claimed that he's about to be indicted for perjury and that he plans to reject the plea deal offered by Mueller. But in a forthcoming book obtained by the Daily Caller, he also says that he worked with longtime Trump advisor Roger Stone to concoct a false cover story to explain the suspicious tweet of Stone's. Okay, in the tweet, Stone seemed to predict trouble coming for one or both of Podesta brothers over a month before the news broke that WikiLeaks had obtained John Podesta's hacked emails. Corsi also writes that Stone asked him to tell Assange to delay the timing of the Podesta email releases. Interesting. Okay. All this, too, should be treated with caution. Corsi is a conspiracy theorist with a history of making false claims, and Stone denied his account to the Daily Caller. but Mueller has been investigating Stone's connections to WikiLeaks for months. If Stone did in fact concoct a false story, it would be suggested that there would be something he wanted to hide about those Podesta emails. Well, anytime you have something that involves Roger Stone, you have to be kind of, Corsi's like, just to switch over to Corsi for a moment, Corsi's like definitely a little on the conspiracy series side of things, you know. I think I mentioned Corsi last week, where I mentioned Corsi was high on Q, and then he denied Q was real. It was LARPing, live action role playing, for those of you who don't know what that is. And then all of a sudden he's back on the Q bandwagon. So I had no idea that he was actually serious enough to be on the Mueller's on his radar per se, you know, because Corsi just always kind of struck me as a bit of a bit player, you know, and I'm also wondering maybe he is now, and he's just trying to parlay this into something for himself. I'm not 100% sure. Roger Stone, I just love. I don't, you know, and Stone's been saying for like at least a year, if not more, he's been saying, just have me down there, have some open hearings and have me down there and I'll tell you the whole deal. And oddly enough, it doesn't appear as if they'd asked him to come down for any serious questioning. So that being the case, you know, and as far as anybody saying that something's going to be happening legally with the Podesta brothers, it really, I mean, they've been on, you talk about the idea of being on the radar, they've been on the radar for so long now, going back to Pizzagate, that it's really not strange. I bet you could find any number of emails that would say something's going to be happening big with the Podestas in that time period, that would predate the release or the knowledge thereof of those emails of that DNC dump. So I don't know what to make of that. I mean, but I read alternative media. I'm very much into Twitter. So I guess that kind of keeps you in the loop on a way or a different wing. I mean, people who are reading this stuff on mainstream, even Vox would be considered like a mainstream publication, obviously, compared to some of the stuff that pops up on Twitter on a daily basis. So, all right, so let me continue with this. Back in September, okay, Manafort's falling out with Mueller seems to be, I'm going to stop doing that, seems to be quite important. Back in September, Paul Manafort agreed to a plea deal with special counsel Robert Mueller's team. The deal averted an imminent second trial for Manafort. He had already been convicted of financial crimes at the first one and required his cooperation. Okay. The news was widely viewed as a likely turning point in Mueller's investigation. It seemed that Mueller had been trying to get Manafort to flip for quite a while and had finally achieved his aim, landing him cooperator close to the president himself. Cooperator. Okay. Anyway. Except it does not seem to have panned out. After giving the plea agreement, Manafort committed federal crimes by lying to the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Special Counsel's Office on a variety of subject matters, which constitute breach of the agreement, and Mueller's team wrote in a filing on Monday evening. Okay, so what that generally means is, because I've gone through the cooperation process myself, as some of you may be aware of, what happens is the way these cooperation agreements generally work is that you agree to cooperate with the government, and you go into agreement, and the government goes into an agreement with you. It's a cooperation agreement where, as you they debrief you and they try to extract all pertinent information to things that they are asking you about. You tell them what they want to know. And you also obviously make yourself available at later date to be a witness at trial if that need be. And what happens is that at the end of the investigation, the federal government or whichever agency you happen to be in agreement with, you know, in this cooperation agreement with, they write what's known as your prosecutor writes what's known as a 51K letter. And in that 51K letter, everything that you've done for the government, and as useful as that information has been to them, goes to your judge at sentencing. And that letter allows the judge, the sentencing judge, to go under the mandatory minimum or whatever you were, whatever the add some of your charges would have been as far as serving time goes. So that means that if you were looking at 25 or 30 years, whatever the term may have been, they can go way under that, and they can even give you time served, or they can give you a few years, you know, whatever it may be. It just allows them to get away from the mandatory minimum sentencing, which has really plagued the federal system for quite some time. Now, I should do a show on that sometime as well. Do I say it every week? I should do a show on stuff. So it's not like I'm running out of material anytime soon. So what happens is that if you break the agreement with them, what happens if you lie to them and they catch you lying, what they can do is they can use all the information that you gave them that was supposed to be helping you go under the mandatory minimum, and they can use that information against you and prosecute you with it if you break the agreement. So what Mueller is alleging is that Manafort broke the agreement by lying to them. Now, obviously, they haven't released us, as was mentioned earlier. They haven't released to us what it is purported that he lied about. But they're saying he's lying. And if they can prove he's lying, then Manafort's in for a problem, a major problem. And maybe some other people, too, depending upon who's involved with the situation. But we don't know anything, and not for nothing, until some information's released, it's all just speculation. Okay. What's particularly interesting is the timing of this disclosure, meaning they're claiming that he lied. Back on November 15th, lawyers for both Mueller and Manafort asked for a short 10-day extension filing their next scheduled status update on his case. This, they said, would let them provide the court with a report that would be of greater assistance in the court's management of this matter, which is interesting wording. This ended up being the Monday evening report claiming Manafort breached his agreement. Oh, okay. So they might have known more than 10 days ago, and they just took the time to either verify it or to see to what degree he had lied. Let's just put it that way. But why the 10-day? What's this? Okay. But why 10-day delay before disclosing this? Good question. There have been no new indictments since then, at least not publicly. There was, however, one notable thing that happened in that period. President Trump submitted his answers to certain questions from Mueller's team last Tuesday. The timing suggests Mueller wanted those answers before revealing Manafort's lack of cooperation. Interesting. Opinion of what this development might mean for the investigation has been split. Some view it likely as a likely blow to Mueller. After all, he's lost a cooperator. Others theorize that Mueller's strongly worded assertion that Manafort lied suggested he's obtained at least some of the evidence that he needs from other sources. But nearly everyone seemed to agree that Manafort was hoping for a presidential pardon. Yeah, interesting. There's been talk of that for like a while now, and that certainly, while it would solve some problems, it certainly wouldn't look very good for the administration. I'll have to say that. Trump, meanwhile, appeared to allude to Manafort's situation in a tweet, claiming Mueller was ruining lives because there are people refusing to lie, presumably to implicate Trump. Trump lawyer Judy Giuliani told Rudy Giuliani, thank God, told CNN that the president had been upset by Manafort's un-American treatment. Okay. And here's a tweet just to indicate that. The phony witch hunt continues, but Mueller and his gang of angry Dems are only looking at one side, not the other. Wait until it comes out how horribly and viciously they are treating people, ruining lives for them, refusing to lie. Mueller is a conflicted prosecutor gone rogue. Okay, that was a tweet by President Trump on November 27 of this year. Okay, so to continue with this article. A new report claims a Manafort WikiLeaks connection, but it's been disputed. Check this out. Did Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort have a secret connection to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange? That's what The Guardian's Luke Harding and Dan Collins reported Tuesday. This was like huge. This thing went like boof. I mean, it made it through my drugs. You understand what I'm saying? So I was even like astonished. I was like, what? What are you saying? So here we go. Claiming Manafort secretly met Assange at London's Ecuadorian embassy three times over the past few years, including in 2016. No direct connection between Assange and Manafort was previously known or reported. Okay. But the report has not yet been confirmed by other media outlets. And it's sourcing is hazy. Oh, wow, hazy. Interesting. So it's best to treat it with caution for now. Oh, good tip. After all, some purportedly game-changing anonymously sourced Trump-Russian scoops have not panned out. Oh, really? WikiLeaks vigorously disputed the claim on Twitter, calling one of the authors a serial fabricator and saying they'd bet $1 million. They'd bet $1 million and its editorial head that Manafort never met Assange. Okay, this is WikiLeaks tweet. Remember the day when The Guardian permitted a serial fabricator to totally destroy the paper's reputation? Is willing to bet The Guardian $1 million in an editor's head that Manafort never met Assange. Okay, so it's basically just a repeat of what I said in Twitter. But that tweet was dated November 27 of this year. All right. And on Tuesday afternoon, to continue the article, Manafort too denied the story. This is totally false and deliberately libelous. He said in a written statement, "I have never met Julian Assange or anyone connected to him. I have never been contacted by anyone connected to WikiLeaks, either directly or indirectly. I have never reached out to Assange or WikiLeaks in any manner. The most significant Russian intervention of the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign was the hacking and eventual leaking of leading Democrats' emails. Two major batches of those stolen emails from the DNC and from John Podesta would eventually be posted on WikiLeaks." Okay, I still maintain that Seth Rich released those emails up to WikiLeaks, that he gave them to WikiLeaks. I still maintain that, and so do a lot of other people. So the fact that they're talking about the DMC hacks being Russian, they weren't hacks. They were done from the inside. I totally disagree with that at this point. Still maintain that at this point in time, and so do a lot of other people. But anyway, for the sake of the article. The question of precisely how all these emails made their way to WikiLeaks and the question of whether any Trump associates were involved in or informed about the operation have so far remained unanswered. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has been investigating these topics, which in particular focus on a Trump advisor and long-time Manafort friend and business associate, Roger Stone. Separate from the question of whether Manafort met Assange is how long it's been known that Manafort traveled to Ecuador in May 2017 to meet with then-incoming President Lenin Moreno. Okay. On Tuesday, after CNN reported that Mueller had been investigating whether WikiLeaks or Assange came up in that meeting, another allegation made the Guardian story. Here we go. So now the Guardian story is now going, yes, from Manafort meeting with Assange at some point in time in the Ecuadorian embassy. This would have been in 2016, still while the election was going on. Amid all this, conservative commentator Jerome Corzi continues to speak out publicly about his entanglement in the Mueller probe. At various points in the past week, he said he's expected to be indicted for perjury, that his lawyers were working on a plea deal, and that most recently he had planned to reject the proposed plea deal. Corsi is a well-known conspiracy theorist who helped popularize the birther theory that Barack Obama wasn't born in the United States, and many other false claims. I'm not so sure that's a false claim. Anyway, I'm the wrong guy to be reading this article. So we wouldn't take his word for much of anything. So Corsi doesn't really have really much traction as far as credibility goes. And that's almost really kind of understandable, quite frankly. But Mueller's interest in him is clearly very real. The special counsel's team subpoenaed Corsi back in August, and he has been questioned by investigators and before a grand jury several times since then, most notably about WikiLeaks, John Podesta's emails, and longtime Trump advisor Roger Stone. I don't understand why they just don't talk to Roger Stone. Just get it over with. God, it's crazy already. Let me get a little bit of coffee here. Yeah, so Corsi's alleged involvement with all this now, it's just another layer of this onion where it's really kind of getting insane. Of course, he has since confirmed that he somehow came to believe that WikiLeaks had obtained Rod Podesta's emails well before the news broke in October 2016. He said that, however, he just figured this out from public evidence, really without explaining how he could have done so. Okay, let me repeat that very slowly. Corsi has since confirmed that he somehow came to believe that WikiLeaks had obtained Podesta's emails well before that news broke in October 2016. Okay. So, wow. Okay. I'm just stunned. I'm just like, well, how could he have, I'm curious how he could have figured that out by public evidence, but it's still interesting to speculate. Now, the Daily Caller's Chuck Ross reports that Corsi has written a book about his experience in the Mueller investigation. Knew that was coming. I believe he just wrote a book on Deep State not going on that long ago. So Corsi generally tends to write on whatever is like new and happening and fashionable, for lack of a better term. You know, that's why I said he was heavily in the queue for a while. And then because I think that there was some commerce to be made in the sense of viewers or listeners, you know, building an audience in that regime, quite frankly. Let's see. He claims to have helped. Okay. Now that the Daily Caller's Chuck Ross reports that Corsi has written a book about his experience with the Mueller investigation, and that in it he claims that he helped concoct a false cover story to help out Roger Stone. Yeah, because I know I'm going to stick my neck out for Roger Stone, right? Yeah, okay. The background is that back on August 21st, 2016, Stone tweeted, "Trust me, it will soon be the Podesta's time in the barrel." Since then, there have been many questions about whether he knew over a month in advance that WikiLeaks would post John Podesta's hacked emails. How do you prove that? I'm going to say one more time, you know, depending upon the context of those emails, John Podesta and his brother have been the target of many speculative thingamajiggles. I mean, I would say that the emails certainly helped, but I mean, they've been viewed as creepy like before then, for sure. So, I mean, I don't understand why, a statement like that. Let me read that statement again. Trust me, it will soon be the Podesta's time in the barrel. I mean, really. But Stone has insisted that there was an innocent explanation. See, he said that the tweet referred to his opposition research that Corsi was doing for him into the Podesta brothers' business dealings. He testified as much to the House. Oh, he did. Okay. He testified as much to the House Intelligence Committee last year, saying, okay, to the Intelligence Committee, but not to the Mueller. Before the Mueller, I get that. Okay. Because I was like, wait, did he do that? Okay. Saying the tweet was partly based on a comprehensive early August opposition research briefing provided to me by investigative journalist Dr. Jerome Corsi. Okay. Corsi writes in his book, however, that this was a cover story, in effect, not true. He said that Stone called him asking for his help and creating an excuse for the suspicious tweet. So he writes, "I suggested Stone could use me as an excuse, claiming my research on Podesta in Russia was based on Stone's prediction." Okay. Stone vehemently denied Corsi's account to the Daily Caller, and as I mentioned, Corsi is unreliable. But the time around Stone's tweet and Corsi's research has long looked shady, as Marcy Wheeler has written. If Stone didn't go to Corsi in search of a cover story, it would certainly raise some questions about what exactly he was trying to cover up. I agree. Elsewhere in the book, Ross writes, Corsi claimed that Stone wanted him to get a message to Assange about how WikiLeaks should time its release of the Podesta emails. He claimed Stone knew a damaging story about Trump would soon be published. The Access Hollywood tape story in which Trump bragged about grabbing women by the pussy was about to break. So Corsi says Stone wanted Assange to delay the release until after this story was out to distract from it. Well, it didn't really do a very good job of doing that, by the way. Stone denied these claims to Ross as well, but WikiLeaks did begin posting Podesta emails shortly after the Washington Post published the Access Hollywood tape story. So this is really kind of interesting, and it's really a bit of a split because the one thing that ties Corsi and Stone together at this point is Alex Jones, because I believe they are both our correspondents are both in some way, shape, or form doing commentary for Alex Jones currently. So this is pretty. I found this to be, like I said, so I was like, what? All right, so that was just on like Tuesday. I want to maybe do a quick one. Let me see one soon block. Here's an interesting story. Do I want to do this one? What do I want to do? I want to do the one out of Russian Times. Oh, isn't it funny using Russian Times? A lot of propaganda. Assange Manafort fabricated. The Assange Manafort fabricated story is a plot to extradite WikiLeaks leader, says Max Blumenthal. Great. So this is Russian Times. The apparently fabricated. And when was this dated? Just want to make sure I got when this was dated. This was also dated November 28th. Okay. So I'm going to go through this real quick. The apparently fabricated report by The Guardian linking Russiagate and Manafort to WikiLeaks The apparently fabricated report by The Guardian linking Russiagate and Manafort to WikiLeaks is laying the case to arrest and extradite Julian Assange to the U.S. Says U.S. investigator Max Blumenthal. WikiLeaks is ready to sue Britain's Guardian newspaper for a fabricated Manafort story that accused Julian Assange of secretly meeting with Donald Trump's former election campaign chairman, Paul Manafort. Manafort agreed to take part in the Mueller probe over Russia's alleged meddling in the 2016 election, but he denies cooperating with Russia or ever meeting Assange. The author of the report, Luke Harding, based his claim on sources and a document written by Ecuadorian CNN intelligence agency, as seen by The Guardian, which the newspaper didn't publish, which is interesting. Investigative reported Max Blumenthal asked why they didn't provide actual evidence from the visitor logs of the European embassy, which are closely watched. Why not show CCTV? London is the most heavily surveilled place on earth. Why not show that? Why rely on a single Ecuadorian source who appears to have been an Ecuadorian intelligence source within MI6 on the other hand of the line and on US on the other, he said in a comment to Russia Times. Hang on. That's better. He believes that it is a fabricated story to lay the foundation. He believes it is a fabrication of a story to be laid. He believes that it is a fabrication of a story to lay the case for the arrest and extradition of Julian Assange by tying him to a figure who was hatching out a plea deal with Robert Mueller, by tying him to Russiagate, to the Russiagate scandal in the U.S. So what they're saying here is that they believe that this is being tied in to the meeting is being tied in, the alleged meeting is being tied in so that they can tie Assange into Russiagate and pull him into the States and extradite him. Into the States, or at least have more reason to expedite him into the States. So Blumenthal noted that the story was being met with more skepticism than usual, even in official circles in Washington, and that it might have failed. Okay. However, he added, once the allegation is made, the damage is done. Many people might have read the story and seen some commentary about it on CNN and judge that Assange did meet with Paul Manafort, he pointed out. Yeah, because it is guilt, particularly with Russiagate. It's all guilt through association. Here we go. Guardian has become bulletin board for fabricated national security state propaganda. Okay. Although WikiLeaks is going to sue over the story, both WikiLeaks and Paul Manafort deny the allegations. The article is still on The Guardian's website. It is sad commentary on what The Guardian has become, basically a bulletin board for fabricated national security state propaganda, Blumenthal said. According to the journalist, this story brings together the Russiagate scandal in Washington and a plot to extradite Assange. We know that there is an indictment of Julian, and it may be made public tomorrow. This was a few days ago. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with your Ecuadorian foreign policy minister earlier this week, which might be the sign that it could be made public. Okay, that meaning the arrest warrant. Blumenthal explained. So that's just fascinating. You know, that's pretty much where that article ends. So it's definitely a standard. We were talking about last week how it's stay tuned, boys and girls, because whatever's going to be happening with Assange could be imminent. But I had you know, I had no idea when I said that it would be the idea of tying him into Russiagate. And have it be claimed that Manafort, of all people, had met with him, and that Stone's involved as well. So, I mean, it sounds stitched together for my take on the matter. But I guess we'll see. Stranger things have happened in the world at large, have it not? Yeah, certainly. You know, it just goes to show. I mean, if you fish around hard enough, which is what the Mueller investigation is doing, you're bound to need to show some sort of results, and it doesn't look like a lot of this is actual results, you know. As was mentioned in that last article, if you have hardcore proof, then put it forward, and that's the end of the story. So we'll have to see if it winds up being substantiated, would be back of a lack of a better word. But no other media has come out and backed that story. They've reported on the story as it exists, but they've not. That's not the same thing as doing the story and coming up with the same results. Anyway, let me get the hell out of here. Please visit lfmidwood.com. That would be the strange thing behind me. That would be lfmidwood.com, lfmidwood.com. You head over there. You got archives. You got my social media. I added a phone number. This little green thing over here is a phone number. That's a Google number, and that goes to a voicemail and or my cell phone at times, depending upon how I have it hooked up. Any of you who don't like the email, who would like to leave a voice message or something along those lines, or contribute something towards the proceedings in a delayed manner, I'd be more than happy to have that call or the content of that call be talked about by me. There is voicemail, and who knows, I may even pick up live and surprise you. I've been known to do that. Anyway, so that's lfmidwood at lfmidwood.com. There's archive, social media, and I can be reached there. There's a little contact thing there. Yep, see that there? You hit that, and that'll open up a little box that'll let you send me a written message, or a type message, I should say. You could, of course, email me at lfmidwood@lfmidwood.com, lfmidwood@lfmidwood.com. There's a link over here to John Lightning's site. That would be 11L/RNI. Takes you right to John Lightning's site. That's it for me tonight. I'm going to play one more tune, and I'm going to get out of here. So I thank you all for imbibing, and remember, don't get in the van until you see the candy.
Filled with thoughts of you, I think about the days of two. I search the room, but you're not there. Your perfume lingers everywhere, but it's only a memory of what I thought was going to be. Only a memory, broken bits of you and me. Takes the blame, but it's should it matter if I cry? I sit around and wonder why. Now I feel much too weak to live, and I've got nothing left to give. Now it's only a memory of what I thought was going to be. Only a memory, broken bits of you and me. Only a memory, only a memory, only a memory.
Been listening to the Midwood Files on Radio New York International. Thanks for listening.